Leaving the shores of your country is both an exhilarating and daunting decision. Navigating the challenges and going further to start businesses is even more challenging. This is the story of Josh Barr, a Ghanaian who left the comfort of his home to pursue a new life in the UK and has now turned into an entrepreneur, leading businesses like Juice, a rent-a-power bank business which is spreading quickly across the UK. In this episode, we delve into his life and how he has leveraged technology to propel his entrepreneurial ambitions. Enjoy today's episode. Okay, so hello everyone and welcome to the Tech Self Podcast, where we navigate today's tech wave one electrifying conversation at a time. I am your host, Raymond Cluche, and today I have the ever effulgent serial entrepreneur Josh Barr to sit with us and walk us through his interesting brain. I just want to just delve into how your mind works. But today we have Josh here to walk us through his entrepreneurial journey, to have a bit more discussion around the things he's done, things that we do not know about, and yeah, just get to know him on a very friendly level. So Josh, thank you so much for making time to join the Tech Self Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's good to be here.
Perfect. Okay, so just to break the ice, we want you in the shortest amount of time at the beginning to introduce yourself, who you are, what you do, and then we can get into details about your life.
Cool. No, thank you very much. So, yeah, my name's Josh. I guess background to myself, I kind of don't know what side to give you, but high level, my background was actually in international development. So I kind of thought I'd go more into that. And then kind of after university, I worked in consulting for a bit and then pivoted into business. I think that was always a bit of a interest in business and a kind of intro. I'll get into kind of where it came from. But yeah, background, I'm Ghanaian and mainly growing up in the UK, but kind of maintain those contacts still, so.
Impressive. So I first met Josh at a dinner and just, you know, cool, calm bloke, not talking too much. I was like, okay, let me just try and engage him. And I'm quite talkative and I could bombard you with chatter, but I was very careful not to bombard you. But after a little bit of talking, I realized that, wow, you are doing very interesting stuff. And I'm just curious, you know, when I was younger, my parents, I've always said I wanted to be a pilot until life gave me other, you know, options. I don't know about you. What led you into the developing an interest for entrepreneurship?
Okay. I think it's probably, I think really it's by consequence of situation. I think that it wasn't necessarily that I was fantasizing over becoming an entrepreneur. Mm. I think that various kind of the environments, my environments around me, whether that's kind of pressures, whether that's financial, whether it's family, whether it's, you know, opportunity, they just kind of presented themselves to me. So it was not really it was like a natural falling into almost. Mm.
Yeah. All right. So what was your first business? What was the first thing you started as an entrepreneur?
I don't know if it counts as a business, but it's so cliche. The classic, everyone was like, every kid was selling the sweets at school.
I was waiting for that.
That was one of my,
okay.
From early, like I remember this was before secondary. Mm. So this was, you know, the age of 10 or so.
Right.
I would be buying polos and selling them at a markup at school. Then I moved schools and then the thing became a bit more advanced. I then started to, like it was summer. I remember one time it was summer and then they had like these drinks they sold for like £1 or 70p, whatever it is. So I just said, oh, okay, I'll do mine for 50p. Mm. So I just started doing those kind of little stuff. And then it kind of went on and on. And then I kind of became known for it. Mm. So that was officially the first business. Yeah.
Right. So in terms of business, did you have any phobias starting any business, like as a normal person, like, you know, just seeing an opportunity? Did you have any major phobias when you were starting any of your businesses?
I think everyone has imposter syndrome as one. You know, you've never done it before. Mm. I think one of my biggest phobias was probably hiring people and having people. Obviously, this is advanced from the sweet selling days now.
Right.
If we're taking it now to when I was like 20 or whatever, 1920, that's, you know, that no, 2021, sorry. It was, yeah, that was a big anxiety I had. Why should they respect me? Why should they listen to what I say? Because I'm just the same age, if not younger, as them. So that was a big challenge for me.
Right. I'm glad you brought that up, because I know you're younger. And I know for an entrepreneur, there is the tendency for people to, you know, associate experience with age. And maybe sometimes you have to hire people who are older than you. You may have people who may maybe be close to your dad's age, or maybe your big brother's age, working for you, and you have to direct, you know, the affairs of the company, and sometimes you have to tell them off. How do you balance that, you know, as the one who is owning a company, empathy, emotional intelligence, at the same time making sure that people are doing the right work?
I think that because it was such a challenge, I figured quite early the best way for me to lead was to lead out of respect rather than out of kind of like a stern voice, for example, being like a micromanager. So I just positioned myself saying, right, well, if I work very, very hard, people know I'm a hustler, it's never a case that Josh is slacking, then they'll respect me. And if they, I'm the one of the hardest working people, then I probably know the most. So by default, if I say A, it means it's time to do A, because I know it. So that was one of the first ways I tried to, I managed to kind of assert some dominance and authority, working with older people,
And have you had any, you know, challenges any time during your, like all your businesses, having to maybe fire someone because the person was just...
I remember the first, so my first, let's say, bigger business was something called Intruders. So we were a streetwear store. And I remember there was one time when there was a case of one girl that she said that she didn't steal an item, but she took it home to wear it and then bought it. Something, whatever it is, we knew we had to kill it quickly.
Right.
And back then I was still working consulting, right? So I finished my day job, finished work at about six in the city of London. Now I'm traveling to Soho to figure out how I'm going to fire this person for the first time in my life. But yes, it is. I think that was a big anxiety, but after you've done it, and I hate the word fire. No one's, you know, it's like Alan Sugar. it's not really like that. I guess it's more like a letting go, saying, right, explaining why it's not the right fit, slash, right, it's like a moldy fruit. If we keep you in the bowl, you're going to deteriorate all the other fruits.
Makes sense. You use the word, you are a hustler. And one who is listening, or maybe people who are listening back in Ghana, will beg to differ, because a hustler who has the chance to move from the shores of Ghana to live in the UK, work in the city of London and everything, that word will rather be, you know, no, he's just trying to, you know, false humility, one will say. Why would you want to call yourself a hustler?
I think a hustler is someone who constantly makes opportunities. Now, you can be in the UK and you can be just comfortable. You can be doing your 9-to-5. You don't need to stress, really and truly. As long as you follow the right steps, you should be able to get a good job. But I guess if you're constantly creating opportunities, you're constantly looking for channels, you're constantly trying to do something new, I think that's what defines a hustler. You know, you're not just settling on the status quo, you know, we're trying to build an empire if need be, for example. So yeah.
And do you feel that the environment in the UK tends to stifle that kind of hustler mindset, especially as immigrants? Maybe you were born here, or because I'm not, you know, I'm not British. We used to come here when we were kids, but I don't know about you. Sometimes you feel like people think you're doing too much?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, often we call it the immigrant mindset. Like, I have a lot of friends growing up in the UK when I was relatively young, you know, like if especially if you're, let's say, if you're comfortable, your grandparents are in the UK, whatever it is, you don't necessarily, it's like you don't really have the vim to go do beyond. You're kind of settled, you're kind of happy, you've got a nice house, your grandma has a nice house, your auntie, everyone's kind of okay. Whereas the immigrant mindset says, okay, you've now, your parents have now suffered to bring you here, for example, or you yourself have come here, you know, you know what it's like back home. So it's like you have to do more, you can't settle, you can't just... One example that comes to mind, it's a random personal story, but I remember when I was in school, we were talking, and they were like, oh, you know, what car are you going to drive by the time you're like 25, for example? This is a random story, but it just came to mind. And I was like, oh, I'm going to have a BMW. Back then, I liked BMW. I felt like I'd have a BMW. And they looked at me like, ah, how will you have a BMW at 25? That's crazy. You'll never have a BMW at 25. That's not possible. And I'm there looking at them like, doing the math, thinking, ah, we finish school at 18, right, go to university, then I have 4 years or whatever to now work before I can do this. Surely it's possible. Right. But for them, it didn't seem possible. Mm. Whereas I guess with the hustler mindset, anything is possible.
Right, right. I like that. I really like that. Speaking of a family, are you here alone in the UK, or you have family, maybe your nuclear family, or... Yeah, I don't know. Tell me about the dynamics of your family.
So I'm actually an only child. Yeah, fun fact. But my family are based in Ghana right now. So yeah, I kind of go and come. I have a very big extended family, which is obviously, I guess, a blessing and a curse in some instances.
True.
But yeah, I'm quite close for a lot of my cousins. Mm. And I guess I adopted them as brothers and sisters. Fair. I was an only child. Yeah.
Fair. Perfect. Okay, now let's go into your business, the entrepreneurial part of you. Yeah. Let's start with juice. So that's what I know you for. The first time I heard about, or I met you, we spoke about juice.
Yeah.
And I know it's co-founded with another friend of yours. Is it Hams? I'm not too sure the pronunciation.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Who gets up and says, I want to rent power banks? Because I would have thought, in terms of, like, when I was preparing for this pod, I was like, maybe he was in Ghana and saw what Doomso could do to people's lives. So it ignited something. But then the business model is not even necessarily targeted to the Ghanaian market.
No,
so then I'm wondering, where does this idea come from, rent power bank? It doesn't, just help.
Okay, so shall I be real? The honest truth is that it wasn't a eureka moment.
Okay.
This business exists out in the Far East, in China, Japan, Singapore, them and there. So, you know, it was a case of seeing, right, well, it works in these kind of environments. Mm. But in the UK, maximum you have is like a charging locker. You don't really have much. Mm. So they're saying, okay, how can we now take it to the next level? With my business partner, I mean, we actually were at school together, constantly discussing business opportunities, always talking through university. Bringing it back to kind of how it came here, I think, because I went to university in London, right? And I remember distinctly, well, I didn't choose King's, really. I didn't think about the finances too much when I chose King's. I chose King's, I wanted to go to a good university and I wanted to be in London. I didn't think how expensive London was. So I got to second year and obviously I'm realizing, ha, the city's expensive. Like, how am I actually going to do? So I'm always thinking, what am I going to do? Now, my friend was in Singapore. The Asians, they were very, very, very big into, like, you know, whether it's Balenciaga, designer stuff, this, that, and the other. So from university, what I was going as I was, you know, in between lectures, I was going to buy some shoes back when those, you know, remember those Balenciaga socks, shock shoes, those shoes that were quite popular. Yeah, so I'd buy them, send them to Singapore, he would sell them. So we were always thinking of opportunities or ringing each other up saying, oh, this opportunity, that opportunity. Mm. So yeah, he ran me one time and just said, look, I've seen this thing in China. Can we do it in the UK? Mm. I was like, well, I'll take a look. And that was it. And we kept on looking, investigating. We thought, maybe there is something here. And then the rest is history.
Right. So walk us through, you know, you get the idea, you start looking into it. What does the first thing look like? I'm going to maybe buy my first charging machine or whatever it is. Like, what did it look like the beginning of Juice?
Okay, so for us, because it's a whole system, right? It's just like the, I guess if you're in London, the Santander bikes, but the idea is you rent a power bank from one location via an app or whatever it is, and then you return it to another location. So we knew that we couldn't simply develop this ourselves. It's not something that you can just say, okay, I'm going to build my app, build my system, make my hardware speak to my app, all that kind of stuff. So we looked at a company already doing it and seeing how we can white label their technology. Mm-hmm. So that means like how we can take their tech, put our logo on it and just sell it as ours type of thing. Mm-hmm. So that's what we did. So initially we weren't called Juice. We were actually called something called Charge Bolt. Right, and that was, they were green, they were ugly, but it worked. They were so we took this Chinese company's technology, we rebranded it Charge Bolts, we signed a distribution agreement with them, and we said, all right, we're going to bring this to the UK, and that was how we first got started.
All right, and then from there you start, you know, getting people on board, you have an app and all that. How was like how were things like from there moving forward till today?
I mean, it was tough. Like, I think that we've got to, you know, I remember the first moment when I spent months setting up the app, setting up a payment processor, because it's not just the app. You now need to convince UK Financial Conduct Authority body that they now can, you know, you're going to accept payments into your bank account and all this type of thing. Right. So I remember the first time I finally did it, we rented, and the £1 went from the app. Actually, I'm thinking, wow, it works, kind of thing.
Right, it felt so good.
It felt so good. I was like, damn, this actually works. So we're like, okay, let's go to everyone. Speak to everyone. Obviously, no one's responding. No one wants to talk to me. No one wants the service. So it took a long time to actually really get that adoption. We thought that we'd be on 1,000 locations in a few months, then 2,000, then 10,000, then just go be the Uber of phone charging. And it didn't happen. It didn't happen that way. It was a very, very gradual grind of door to door, speaking to one shop owner. Do you want this? Can you take this? Please, just take it. Just take it. It's free. Just let me just leave it here, type of thing. And then gradually we build up the network.
Impressive. Speaking about names, what made you think about Juice? You know, is it drink juice or?
Yeah,
yeah, go for it.
Yeah, no, the idea was, I guess, because we were chargeable and we needed to change our name. So what happened is after the pandemic, when the pandemic first hit, we decided to actually set up Juice and move away from this distribution agreement for many reasons. Mm. We're like, look, I don't want to be just taking someone's technology. I want it to be my own. So I was thinking like, okay, I want this to be global. I want it to be big. What's also like a synonym of charge? Like we kind of thought, oh, you know, you need some juice. Oh, I'm running low on juice, like as in orange juice or whatever. So we were just there thinking, okay, J-U-I-C-E, this, that, and the other. Then we eventually settled on, juice in its current iteration, and we ran with them. We were kind of concerned thinking, what are other cultures? How are people going to pronounce it? Will the Americans say it funny? Will people be affected? You know,
people say Joss.
Exactly.
Or Joes.
But it kind of acts as like a bit of a icebreaker. Often you speak to someone and they'll pronounce it completely wrong. And you're just like, all right, well, actually, this is how you pronounce it. But now let's talk. So
that is impressive. Now, I don't know about you. I don't know what the word juice has to do with, because there's another company you have that is Juice Solar.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering, what's up with you and Juice? Like, what's up with you? Are you a Juice fan? Are you a Juice maker? Are you a mixologist? You tell me.
I guess by the time we came up with Juice Solar, or, you know, we had done Juice for a while, and a lot of people knew us as Juice.
Okay.
So Juice Solar is really, not really a spin-off, but we've built Juice into a wider power brand, right? Mm. The power banks wasn't enough. It's great. It's a cool Trojan horse. But really, to be able to do something a bit bigger, we thought, you know, we want to get into renewable energy or whatever it is. So Juice Solar is really just living off Juice's hype. Shopping centers, hospitals, people know Juice. So it's like, okay, consider the solar solution for that. Yeah.
All right. Before we come to Juice Solar, because I'm also intrigued by that, how would you say Juice is doing? I saw Juice in town, or I've seen Juice several times.
Yeah.
And when I saw it first, I was like, yo, I know Juice, because it rang a bell. Then I texted you and I was like, isn't this your company? And I was like, yeah, like, oh, whoa, I'm texting a celebrity here. But anyways, I was just like intrigued to know that it wasn't just an idea that was just centered around London. You were just doing it like in a small, it was like a small vending machine. It was actually in different city, because I was in a different city at the time.
Yeah.
So how would you say it's going well? Like, how would you say it's going at the moment? And where have you guys reached? And where's like, what is the next expansion you guys are looking forward to doing?
Yeah, so I mean, the last years were really just about kind of solidifying the UK markets. So we were saying, right, we want to be in every major city from Aberdeen to Southampton. So for those who don't know, Aberdeen is right at the top of Scotland. This is far. I've never been there myself. And no disrespect
but
to them.
Juice has been.
Juice has been, exactly. Juice has been. So yeah, and then, that was the UK thing. Now we're looking more at Europe and further afield. So we've set up a subsidiary in Lisbon. So we've got a European company now. We needed to do that because of Brexit. because British people want it to be difficult. So yeah, we have that now. And for European expansion, we've got a few European countries lined up. We've just launched Canada as well. So Canada's going to be launching in November, so end of this month. And then, yeah, it's really just about replicating the success we've seen in the UK into different markets.
All right, now let's get into Juice Solar. It's your desire for us to use renewable energy more from personal experience. Like I keep saying, I keep making reference back to Doomsong because we are both Ghanaian, right? And even if you are the most affluent person in Ghana, after a while, you know, having to pay for generator or having to pay for all of that, you know, it becomes expensive. So even the average affluent person will still complain.
Yeah.
What do you think led you to starting Juice Solar in the first place?
I'm a big believer in off-grid energy production. And maybe this does stem from Ghana, right? Because, you know, I guess Ghana, we unfortunately haven't necessarily developed the infrastructure to build an extensive national grid. So we're complaining in Accra, let alone if you're further afield. So, you know, I'm a big believer in off-grid, and I think solar's, I may be biased because obviously we have a solar energy company, but I think it's one of the most powerful solutions for that. So yeah, I mean, in the UK and Europe and stuff, we're looking at kind of putting solar for shopping centers, big sites. Think of them as mini power stations. And then you can sell that energy back to the national grids. So for Ghana, we'll be looking to sell it back to ECG. Obviously, there's lots of risks there, but yes, that's the principle. But there's also a domestic market in Ghana, like probably more of a domestic market because people need it. People need their own energy production. So yeah.
People find people in Ghana find solar to be very expensive. How does Juice Solar hope to provide affordable energy to Ghanaians, but still be able to make some very good profit in that regard?
Yeah, so I think that it's really about flipping the model on its head. So there's one side doing the domestic market, and there's challenges because, you know, you don't just need a solar panel. You might need an inverter. You'll need an energy storage battery system, all these types of things, which makes it quite expensive. Now, the costs are projected to go down a lot in the next 5 years, so this could change things. But for me, I think the solution is really a different approach. Like I say, having these micro power, let's call them mini power stations, they can be localized. And yes, you do need government involvement. It could be a private-public partnership. But I think those type of solutions, that eases the energy draw on the grid in Ghana, that will actually allow us to have a bit better energy. I'm not sure if I'm explaining it well. So essentially what I'm saying is that it doesn't have to be a case where everyone buys their own solar panel. We should start to think a bit more strategically.
Right.
As a country, as a neighborhood, as a community. If you're living in Manette, should there be a few around that area to cover that area? I think that's the cheapest way to do it. If everyone just does one, yeah, it's going to be expensive because every single person needs their own battery system.
Yeah.
And it's not the most effective way to do it.
And it's not the most affordable as well. Now, I'm trying to draw a line between, you know, Juice and your next company, which actually happens to do with, like, or it's related to something around food.
Yeah.
Which is Nosh. And I'm just wondering, like, Josh, before we even get into Nosh, what does your brain look like on a daily? Like, like, how do you get these ideas? Because I would say the closest thing I've done to entrepreneurship is starting this pod. And it's been hard. It's been difficult, but it's been very rewarding, you know, hearing people say, I learned this from your pod. I was able to start this and all that. I met this person through your pod. Has been refreshing.
Yeah.
You get it. But I'm yet to start, you know, a product-based like kind of business, something that, you know, has to do with like a product I'm building or whatsoever. What does your brain do? Like, how do you get these ideas and how do you run with them for a curious, like an aspiring entrepreneur over here?
I don't even know how to, I think, like I said, it's the environment. So if you want to know why we started Nosh, the true honest reason is because we were suffering with Juice. You see, like, not everything was super, like, I guess now it might sound, and even now it's not super rosy, but it's been a tough ride to build this business. And I remember, you know, the days where when I was building Juice, where I wouldn't wish the stress that we had on one of my worst enemies. And I'm serious when I say that. I wouldn't wish, because you've got the response. It's like having a baby. You've got a responsibility to now feed that baby, to send it to school, to do whatever. You can't now kick the baby on the streets. You're responsible. For Nosh, we set that up primarily because we said, well, we need to make more money. Juice had its trajectory like this. It was going up, but gradually. We know a lot of contacts. We know a lot of these, like I mentioned, shopping centers, train operators, hospitals, whatever. We had a lot of contacts in the UK. We said, right, what else can we sell to them? What else do they need? Again, looked far afield. Same principle as Juice. Looked at Japan. Looked at, you know, they have a lot of, let's say, hot food vending solutions. And that's kind of how Nosh was born. Again, bring some technology over, investigate, pitch it to someone. Does it work? Can we adapt it? Right now, we've pivoted the business completely. So we're not actually doing vending machines. We've developed a new technology, which is really cool. It's like a packaging, but again, still in the food industry. So yeah, that's kind of going on its own path right now. But if you say, how did we start this? Honestly, it wasn't out of joy. Like, I didn't wake up and just think, you know what? I want extra stress, extra business, like another. I didn't really, that wasn't why. It was literally, how can we make more money to pay the bills and pay these employees that I've hired for Juice? That was why we started all these businesses.
You identify as a serial entrepreneur. How many employees do you have under your belt?
About 20 in China, 30 in the UK, and about 15 in Ghana, and maybe one in Europe.
Why do you have this much stress on your head?
I can't answer that question. I don't know. I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. Sometimes I ask myself the same question. Why? But I don't know. I have a feeling that I'm doing what I'm meant to be doing. So I just kind of continue that and keep praying and, you know, stay close to God. That's all you can do sometimes. Right. So
since you mentioned that, I want to assume that, you know, you're a religious person, Christian, spiritual. You're Christian, I believe. Yeah. Okay. And how has that played a huge role in the way you live your life and run your business?
I mean, it's very clear. In fact, we would not be here if not for God. That's my belief. But also, I don't think the business would exist if I wasn't Christian. Because there's sometimes when you have to have a sense of like this crazy faith that just means that you're going to continue. You believe, you know, what God has said regarding this matter, so you will continue. You will. Nothing says you should continue. On paper, it's all red. You should not continue. Rather, you should go sleep. But you have this sense that you have to go ahead. So I think, and my partner is not Christian, right? But I also look at it like, and he recognizes that if I was not Christian, the business wouldn't have continued either, because we've got to be committed to doing something crazy almost. Yeah,
that is impressive. Now, with your experience, I know you are an angel advisor or angel investor and everything in so many ways, shapes or form. How do you balance that with your normal entrepreneurial work? You know, what kind of investment outside Juice do you do? What kind of consulting do you offer to businesses? Are you flown in and out of different countries to solve people's problems? What kind of consulting for businesses and advisory do you offer?
So currently, I guess I've angel invested in a few companies. Now that tends, as I'll typically do early stage, so I'll often kind of advise and help them, let's say, with regards to their commercial strategy, their operational strategy, just because I've done it before. So yeah, I'm doing that with a few companies right now. I'm not really flown out, unfortunately. I don't, maybe the only place at that is Ghana. So working with a few companies. I'm hoping to set that up soon. So yeah, it's very passive. Let's say quarterly meetings. It's nice to think about things that are a bit different sometimes. So
nice, I like that. Let's get away from typical entrepreneurial stuff and get into how you unplug. I want to assume that you are so swamped, you're so busy, always in and out of meetings, emails, and all that. How do you unplug? What do you do? What is your life like outside your typical serial entrepreneurship life?
Yeah, no, good. People often ask. I mean, I don't think my work-life balance has been great, being very real. I think the seasons to it. And I've had to kind of have some peace with that because it's, you know, sometimes I am very social. I'll be, you know, going out, seeing friends, doing whatever. And other times I'm not really able to do much. It is really just office, get home, more work, wake up, more work. Sometimes in the night too, you're in bed, but you're responding to something just because China, the time difference and everything. So I know I haven't answered your question, but essentially it's the standard stuff. I play the drums. That was like my release a lot for a lot. So often I'd like go from the office, just like play out. My friend was recording a album. So I was like helping her on the drums with that. That was like one thing I did. Yeah, I love to travel. So I have a thing whereby obviously I'm passionate about the continent, but for me, I feel that, and a lot of Ghanaians, we fall into this tragedy. It's just between London, Accra.
You won't actually go
anywhere else, even in Ghana, Seth. So for me and my friends, we basically set aside and said, right, we're going to visit one new African country every year. So far, that's like one thing we've been doing. And yeah, so I'd say a bit of travel, a bit of going out, that kind of stuff.
Impressive. I'm actually going to, you know, say that is very true. Even for someone who has been in Ghana for about 24 years, I can count the number of places that I have been to in Ghana, like internal travel. And yeah. I had a friend of mine who was on my episode. I don't know if you know about Move Africa. He started this business where they, you know, go on international, I can call it international.
So they do travel, right?
Yes.
So they do I've seen them on Twitter.
So he's actually my friend. We're both classmates. You should listen to the episode with him on the pod. It's a very insightful story. And I always find it, you know, like every time I go to Ghana, I'm like, I'm going to try and get to one of those travels. Until I have to meet one friend after the other, chit-chat, and then your whole vacation is ended. But I've made up my mind that I'm going to be very deliberate about my travel this time around, because I also love the continent. I want to meet places. I was very happy to see that Rwanda has gotten rid of the visa.
Yeah.
I was like, let's go. I don't care. I prefer emptying my bank account and just going to have a good time. But yeah, I think that is very good.
And I mean, Rwanda, Kenya, South Africa, like right. The trend is there. Yeah. People are trying to really promote this Pan-African travel. So.
And I think that's the way forward, because it's going to help with trade. It's going to help with, you know, a lot of things that we are always complaining about on the continent. So maybe it's a step in the right direction.
Yeah.
How have your parents played a huge role in your entrepreneurial journey?
Okay. Yeah, no, a massive role. I think besides the standard encouragement, I think there's the whole side of, you know, you know, Ghanaian parents. Now you've got, they've put you through school. You've done everything. You've now got a job. But you get to a point where you're now saying, hey, I actually want to leave that job and do something completely different. And for me, that first thing was streetwear. How do you now explain streetwear versus consulting? So it was a hard pitch, but they've been very supportive. And I think it's one of the main driving factors as well. Fair. I think having everyone has a drive. Everyone has a why. Why are you doing what you're doing? What are you trying to achieve with what you're doing? And I think having that why definitely gives a bit more motivation to really try and achieve it and make something of yourself, you know?
All right. As a young entrepreneur yourself, what would you say is affecting or is hurting a lot of entrepreneurs out there like yourself who are also younger, but trying to, you know, break through different barriers and, you know, achieve great things? What do you think is one of the main issues or some of the main issues that you guys face?
I think investment, but also in terms of having the right advice, right? So investment, because particularly, you know, a lot of Ghanaian startups that we just don't have the access to funding that a lot of, you know, startups in other countries do. So I think that's one side that there's a challenge, but then also that advice in terms of, right, you've made your first $100. How do you now get that to 1,000? how do you now develop different channels, different sales strategies, different pillars of growth, different, you know, how do you now take that to the next stage? And I think that is, it's hard because, you know, a lot of people will just make it up on the go, but it makes it a lot easier if you have someone advising you and giving you a bit of a hint or steps or tips on the way. Mm-hmm. You don't necessarily have, you know, people with gray hair able to advise you and say, oh, who's done it before, right? To say, okay, you need these sales strategies. You need these pillars of growth. You need these channels to 10X your business.
Right.
Or whatever it is, or you're going to have to show 300% growth in this many months so that you can get investment. So these type of things, people don't have that knowledge. So I think that's one thing that I'm with my company in Ghana right now, currently I'm trying to help some startups with that as well.
We've not really spoken much about that. Can you just, you know, give us a bit of a quick overview about what you guys do in Ghana or what you're doing in Ghana, and just a quick overview.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, the Ghana company, we started off as an outsourcing company. So Juice, this is a good example. Juice is, the customer service for Juice is all done in Ghana. Anyone who, if you have a problem on the app, on that station you saw in town, and you contact Juice, someone in Ghana will be responding. Now, you won't know they're in Ghana, but that was all done through my Ghana company. So we do back-end support, admin, graphic design, UI, UX design, that type of things for UK companies, particularly UK startups. And that's the company in Ghana. And then we've pivoted slightly just because that business is good, but I don't have enough time to scale it. So we're pivoting a little bit now. We're still maintaining the outsourcing side, but we're working with a few startups, and we're looking to invest in them. We're looking to advise their C-suite and really help them get from, okay, you've made $1,000. How do we turn it into $10,000? How do we turn it into $100,000? Et cetera, et cetera. So that's kind of what we're looking at now. It's a bit on that advising and investment piece.
Someone listening who is younger or even maybe in their mid-30s wants to start a business, has an entrepreneurial drive, whether in Ghana or whether here in the UK or whatsoever, and is thinking about how do I get started? How do I align myself? I didn't get a chance to go to King's College. I don't have a business degree, blah, blah, blah. But I have an idea. I think it will work. You know, if you could give your best advice to a young entrepreneur, maybe one who has already started or one who is about to start, how they can go about it and potentially increase their chances of succeeding.
Yeah, no, sure. I'd say figure out who your customer is, focus on them, and really ensure you have that product market fit. And I'll break this down, right? So who your customer is, I guess that's your target. A lot of people kind of sometimes can want to start a business just because they think that it's a good idea, but you've really got to put yourself in the shoes of your potential customer. Until you've put yourself in the shoe of the customer and said, right, imagine I'm the customer right now. How am I saving myself money? How am I revolutionizing my life? How am I making my business sell five times more than I could previously sell before I worked with this? I think they're the kind of questions you need to ask when I say thinking about your customer. Then number two is the product market fit. So ensuring that I don't feel Juice would work in Ghana for a number of reasons, but you got to make sure that the market fit is there. So we were talking about solar before. Now, we may not want to rely on ECG to make those power grids, but so for product market fit for Ghana, we'd need to have a domestic solution, right? We'd need to have something that people can buy themselves and just, you know, put on their roof or whatever it is. So I think those are the two first big things that I say. If you focus on those two, then just get started, that should be able to help you. Yeah.
Now, with all your businesses here, you have competitors in that market. How do you survive? I'm just curious. How do you deal with competitors in the market on a daily?
I'd say just be aware, but don't think about them. Someone can always come and start a business like you or whatever, but fundamentally, if you always think about what's your comparative advantage, like, and why you're better, I think you've just got to back yourself sometimes. one of our biggest competitors. It was a big challenge, and it's kind of been a bit of a rivalry, right? And they particularly put their charges in pubs. So, you know, British people, they love their really pubs. They love to have their beer, that's on the other. Very good pints, exactly. Where, so I said, I can't get in the pubs. Me, I wasn't going to pubs, so I didn't really know how to speak to the pub owners and all this stuff, right? So I said, okay, fine, we'll build our business on the back of shopping centers or whatever it is. So we picked a different vertical or a different way to do the same business. Not that we gave up on pubs, but we just found a way to make ourselves unique. But yeah, I don't think you should... You can get into a habit of really focusing on what the competition are doing, getting anxious that they've done this, they've done that. But fundamentally, just focus on building yourself and making sure that your business is good. And I think that's the best advice I can give.
Now let's get into a few numbers. Now I know it's a very delicate place and you wouldn't want to maybe drop some numbers for personal reasons, which is perfectly fine. But if you could just give estimate of what it costs you to run a business like this and possibly how much you guys have made so far.
Yeah, sure. So I don't know if, in fact, here's a good example. People, I'm not sure if people are aware that Uber has only just made a profit this summer.
Oh, well, I wasn't aware. So that's new.
Uber has been negative all this time. They've been pouring money, but how are they able to do that? Partly because they have a lot of rich, let's say, European investors. They have a, you know, they have that advice. They have all those, you know, things that are able to support them. So Juice, you know, we haven't made, like right now, if we look at the business on net, it's not profitable. Month on month, we're profitable. And that's been a very, very big challenge we've got there. But in terms of what it's taken to get here, it's not profitable yet. But we've scaled. I mean, we've gone from obviously making 1,000 a month to 10,000 a month to 100,000 a month, right? So it's really, really scaled and taken off. Typically costs, I mean, your costs are a lot. I don't know how to explain it. The costs are a lot because by the time you've added up salaries, you've now bought an extra 10,000 power banks. You've now paid for petrol for someone to carry the power bank from London to wherever you saw it. They're not like, there's a lot of operating costs of the business. But the value is like the fact that we have all these contacts and it's a bit of a Trojan horse. So yeah, month on month we make money, but we're going to get to the point where we're going to be breaking even, kind of like Uber, and then go on from there.
And is that the same thing for all your other companies, Nosh, Solar, Juice Solar, and the others that we do not know of yet?
Juice is actually the biggest company out of all of them. Yeah, so Juice is, that's like, you know, Juice is the biggest company, and that's cost over like a million annual turnover, and it's that the other ones are, they started later, so they're going on their own path.
All right. Yeah, that is impressive. That is very good. Now you are leveraging a lot of technology. You know, I know my pod is a tech self podcast, but I also like to have entrepreneurial journeys because I believe entrepreneurs will eventually have to use technology to, you know, push whatever it is they're offering to customers, because technology is the new order of the day, right? How would you say technology has played a huge role in how you go about things, you know, in terms of maybe planning, in terms of even distribution? You did mention that you at the early stages of Juice, you had to deal with the payment system and all of that is technology. All of those are APIs and everything that are behind these systems. How has technology been very impactful in your entrepreneurial journey?
That's a very good question. I guess we're fundamentally a hardware company, but it operates under software. It's been challenging. It's been challenging. I think in terms of how it's helped the journey. Sorry, that was your question, right? How it's helped the journey. Yeah. So how it's helped the journey? I mean, I don't, you know, this business alone wouldn't work without its app. Now we do contactless payments for people with cards and they've run out of battery. But, you know, to start with, you needed an app or you need a smartphone for that. There's challenges around kind of working on the user experience, right? You've got to make it super, super easy for people to use. One funny thing, as I always say, no one really wants to use our products. You know, imagine you're low on battery, you're already upset. You're already not happy. Now you're now saying someone you should pay £2 or £3 and I'll charge your phone. You're extra upset. But then you're now having to download an app. You're stressed. You're on 3% already. So the user is already in not a very happy place when they're interacting with our service. So all they want is just to tap, tap, tap and get the power bank quickly. So yeah, we use some kind of data tracking. Apps Flyer is a good one, but we use some kind of tracking software to really monitor that user journey to the point that we can get it down to under 60 seconds. Now you just quickly scan the QR code and you can grab a power bank really, really, really quickly. So we developed something, Apple developed something called App Clips. I'm not sure if you're familiar, but a lot of, so that it's like, instead of having to download a full app, you can have like a mini app. So that's one thing that really helped us just reduce that user journey as well. And then I think on the hardware piece, how has technology helped us or changed us on that front? I mean, technology is constantly adapting. Just this September, they said that they're not using lightning cables for the new iPhones, right? So for us, our lightning cable is in the middle of the power bank. Why? Because it's the main one that people use. So for now, we're going to change our design and we're going to put USB-C in the middle because that's now going to become the leading charging cable. There's still about a 2-3 year lag for that, right? So it's not something that we're immediately stressed about, but those types of things do affect our business.
I was going to ask this when we were talking more about Jews, but maybe this is a good time to ask. In terms of people not returning the power banks and everything, you know, I'm sure because you have their payment details, you're able to charge them, or maybe eventually the power bank becomes theirs. Are they able to charge it back in their home or whatever it is? Have you had to deal with such situations, and how does your business model cater for things like that?
Yes. It worked for 90% of the time. We take your card details, and if you don't return the power bank, we charge you for the power bank. We're happy, you're happy, you can charge that at home. It becomes your personal power bank. However, for 10% of the time, or whatever the numbers are, these are just arbitrary numbers, it doesn't work. Maybe someone doesn't have that amount in their bank account. Maybe they've been sneaky, they had it in initially, and then they've taken it out, or you know they find a way to kind of hack through the system or whatever. So we factored it into our business model, right? That sometimes we will lose power banks. Sometimes people will get a power bank and they just will not return it, and they won't have money in their bank account and this, that, and the other. And these are one of the many reasons why it really, you know, you can only do it in certain countries. You can only do it in certain.
I like how you said you can only do it in certain countries. We're not going to disclose our inside joke. We just keep it as is.
We just keep it moving exactly. Like you have to rely on that in a sense. But it's the same as, I mean, So essentially we factored it in, and now we've just changed something. We're testing it, whereby we actually take your money up front, and then if you return it, we give you back your money.
We're about to conclude, and the first time I met you, I knew it was going to be, you're a nice person. I knew this episode was going to be very electrifying, and I haven't, you know, regretted or haven't missed out on anything. Like, I think the whole conversation has been very good. For me especially, it's been a booster to this whole pod I've started. It's been very interesting. I started about 4 months ago in July. And the fact that I'm even already hitting about 1,000 listens on Spotify, I'm like, people just come to listen to me talk, ask people, and be the sanguine that I am. It's intriguing. And the Pivoting Career series has been, you know, very good, very great. And I've concluded on that. So I'm now getting into more, you know, similar topics like yours, you know, entrepreneurial kind of stuff, intersecting that with tech. And as one who is a serial entrepreneur, I'm sure you're never satisfied with what you have achieved. What is the next big thing? Like, what is the next big thing you want to get into? Do you probably want to become a dancer? Maybe have juice dance, or you want to become a full-time chef, or maybe you want to, you know, become a musician, because I think you said you play drums, or maybe, you know, become a producer. Yeah. What is the next big thing Josh is going to work on?
That's a good question again. I joke with myself saying we're not starting another business for another 12 months at least. I'm tired. I'm tired. Like I want to just focus on what we have currently. So I'd say I think I believe in solar. I'm really interested in the solar opportunity. I really see that as, and for me, like, I do business because I believe that business is the leader for development. If you look at how America developed so fast, how Singapore, the Asian tigers, how they really developed their countries, it was through, you know, building industry and building industrialization. So for me, I think it's more of the same. I think the solar opportunity is good. I'd love to expand that into Ghana and do more in Ghana with solar, but I'm also into agriculture, surprisingly, agro-processing. There's a lot of industries that I think are really about to boom in Ghana. There's a big opportunity we have. So I think what's next? Maybe you're right. Maybe I am lying. More of the same. We'll keep going.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Josh, I don't want to let you go, but because I know that you are maybe the next Kwame Nkrumah who's going to save the situation in Ghana, and I want you to go and, you know, rack your brain, think through all the things you're doing and do it very well, I will let you go. I just want to first say thank you for making time. I really respect your time. I know you're a busy man, but you made time. And I also want to say I admire your resilience, your dedication to what you're doing. And I'm inspired, you know. I'm yet to start, like as I said, a product-based business. And if ever I'm looking for inspiration, I'm knocking at your door. We're going for coffee. We're going for tea. We're going for lunch. We're going for brunch, whatever it is. I just need to sit with you more. But thank you for also showing that you can leave the shores of Ghana, come to the UK, and make it work. Because when I saw your article in Forbes, I was like, this is good. It makes immigrants not look like we are just, you know, security men and co. But we can actually, you know, be of benefit to the economies that we find ourselves in.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
So
yeah,
thank you so much. And I hope you had a great time.
No, thank you so much for having me. And yeah, no, real pleasure to be here. And thanks for everyone for listening. And keep supporting your podcast.
Well, they're doing a good job already. So since you guys heard, Josh said you should support. So do a good job to support.
Navigating new terrains would always be challenging, especially as an immigrant. Like they say, growth is in the discomfort, and this is evident in the life of Josh Barr. Amidst the challenges and roadblocks, his determination and belief in his dreams, coupled with his faith in God, have been driving forces that have led to where he is today. An inspiring story for every entrepreneur out there navigating a new terrain. Thank you for listening. See you in the next episode.